married. Hawthorne House became the Olson House. All of this, she raises her arms in the air like a music conductor, was his. I picture my father sitting with the Maloneys in their cozy cottage, knitting that blanket while they regale him with stories about the White House in the distance, how three Hawthorns bestowed their new name on this spit of land, and one built this very house. The spinster daughter who lives there now with her parents, their three sons dead. No heir to carry on the family name.
Do you think Papa was in love with Mother?
I ask. Mamay pats my hand. I don't know. I really don't. But here's the truth, Christina. There are many ways to love and be loved. Whatever led your father here, this is his life now. I want more than anything for Papa to be proud of me, but he has little reason. For one thing, I am a girl. Even worse, I know this already, though no one's ever actually said it to me. I am not beautiful. When no one is around, I sometimes inspect my features in a small, cloudy fragment of mirror that's propped against the windowsill in the pantry. Small gray eyes, one bigger than the other. A long, pointy nose. Thin lips.
It was your mother's beauty that drew me,
Papa always says. And though I know now that's only part of the story, there's no question that she is beautiful. High cheekbones, elegant neck, narrow hands and fingers. In her presence I feel ungainly, a waddling duck to her swan. On top of that, there's my infirmity. When we're around other people, Papa is tense and irritable, afraid that I'll stumble, knock into someone, embarrass him. My lack of grace annoys him. He is always muttering about a cure. He thinks I should have kept the leg braces on. The pain, he says, would have been worth it. But he has no idea what it was like. I would rather suffer for the rest of my life with twisted legs than endure such agony again. His shame makes me defiant. I don't care that I make him uncomfortable. Mother says it would be better if I weren't so willful and proud. But my pride is all I have. One afternoon, when I am in the kitchen shelling peas, I hear my parents talking in the foyer. Will she have to stay there alone? Mother asks, her voice threaded with worry. She's only 7 years old, John.
I don't know.
What will they do to her?
We won't know until she's looked at, Papa says.
A finger of fear runs down my back. How will we afford it?
I'll sell a cow if I must.
I hobble toward them from the pantry. I don't want to go.
You don't even know what...
Papa starts. Dr. Heald already tried. There's nothing they can do. He sighs.
I know you're afraid, Christina, but you have to be brave.
I'm not going. That's enough. It's not up to you. Mother snaps. You'll do as you're told. The next morning, as dawn is beginning to seep through the windows, I feel a rough push on my shoulder, a shake. It takes a moment to focus, and then I am staring into my father's eyes.
Get dressed, he says. It's time.
I feel the soft, shifting weight and dull warmth of the hot water bottle against my feet like the belly of a puppy. I don't want to, Papa.
It's arranged. You know that. You're coming with me,
he says in a firm, quiet voice. It's cold, and still mostly dark, when Papa lifts me into the buggy. He wraps the blue wool blanket he knitted around me and then two more, adjusts a cushion behind my head. The buggy smells of old leather and damp horse. Papa's favorite stallion, Blackie, stamps and whinnies, tossing his long mane as Papa adjusts his harness. Papa climbs into the driver's seat, lights his pipe, and flicks the reins, and we set off down the hard-packed dirt road, the buggy squeaking as we go. The jostling hurts my joints, but soon enough I adjust to the rhythm, drifting to sleep to the lulling sound. Clump, clump,
Clump, opening my eyes some time later to the cold yellow light of a spring morning. The road is muddy. Melting snow has created streams and tributaries. Hardy clusters of crocuses, purple and pink and white, sprout here and there in slush-stained fields. In 3 hours on the road, we pass only a few people. A stray dog emerges from the woods to trot alongside us for a while, then falls back. Now and then, Papa turns around to check on me. I glare at him from my nest of blankets. Eventually, he says over his shoulder,
"This doctor is an expert. I got his name from Dr. Heald. He says he will do only a few tests."
How long will we be there?
I don't know.
More than one day?
I don't know.
Will he cut me open?
He glances back at me.
I don't know. No point worrying about that.
The blankets are scratchy against my skin. My stomach feels hollow.
Will you stay with me?
Papa takes the pipe out of his mouth, tamps it with a finger, puts it back in and takes a puff. Blackie clip-clops through the mud and we lurch forward.
Will you?
I insist. He doesn't answer and doesn't look back again. It takes 6 hours to reach Rockland. We eat hard-boiled eggs and currant bread and stop once to rest the horse and relieve ourselves in the woods. The closer we get, the more panicked I become. By the time we arrive, Blackie's back is foamy with sweat. Though it's cold, I'm sweating too. Papa lifts me out of the buggy and sets me down, ties up the horse and attaches its feed bag. He leads me down the street by one hand, holding the address of the doctor in the other. I am woozy, trembling with fear.
Please don't make me, Papa.
This doctor could make you well.
I'm all right the way I am. I don't mind it.
Do you not want to run and play like other children?
I do run and play.
It's getting worse.
I don't care.
Stop it, Christina. Your mother and I know what's best for you.
No, you don't.
How dare you speak to me with this disrespect?
He hisses, then quickly glances around to see if anyone noticed. I know how much he dreads making a scene. But I can't help it. I'm crying now.
I'm sorry, Papa. I'm sorry. Don't make me go, please.
We are trying to make you better,
he says in a violent whisper.
What are you so afraid of?
Like a slight tidal pull that presages the onset of a huge wave, my childish protests and rebellions have been only a hint of the feelings that well inside me now.
What am I so afraid of?
That I'll be treated like a specimen, poked and prodded again, to no end. That the doctor will torture me with racks and braces and splints. That his medical experiments will leave me worse, not better. That Papa will leave, and the doctor will keep me here forever, and I'll never be allowed to go home. That if it doesn't work, Papa will be even more disappointed in me.
I won't go. You can't make me,
I wail, wrenching away from him and running down the street.
You are a mulish, pig-headed girl,
he yells bitterly after me. I hide in an alley behind a barrel that smells of fish, crouching in the dirty slush. Before long, my hands are red and numb, and my cheeks are stinging. Every now and then I see Papa stride by, looking for me. One time he stops on the sidewalk and cranes his neck, peering into the dimness, but then he grunts and moves on. After an hour or so, I can't take the bitter cold any longer. Dragging my feet, I make my way back to the buggy. Papa is sitting in the driver's seat, smoking his pipe, the blue wool blanket around his shoulders. He looks down at me, a grim expression on his face.
Are you ready to go to the doctor?
I stare back at him.
No.
My father is stern, but he has little tolerance for public displays. I know this about him, in the way you learn to identify the weak parts of the people you live with. He shakes his head, sucking on his pipe. After a few minutes, he turns abruptly, without a word, and jumps down from the buggy. He lifts me into the back, tightens Blackie's harness, and climbs back into the driver's seat. For the entire 6-hour ride home, he is silent. I gaze at the stark line of the horizon, as severe as a charcoal slash on white paper, the steely sky, a dark spray of crows rising into the air, bare blue trees just beginning to bud. Everything is ghostly, scrubbed of color, even my hands, marbled like a statue. When we arrive home, after dark, Mother meets us in the foyer, baby Sam on her hip. "What did they say?" she asks eagerly. "Can they help?" Papa removes his hat and unwraps his scarf. Mother looks from him to me. I stare at the floor.
"The girl refused."
"What?"
"She refused. There was nothing I could do."
Mother's back stiffens. "I don't understand. You didn't take her to the doctor?"
"She wouldn't go."
"She wouldn't go?" Her voice rises. "She wouldn't go? She's a child!" Papa pushes past her, removing his coat as he walks. Sam starts to whimper.
"It's her life, Katie."
"Her life?" My mother spits. "You are her parent."
"She threw a terrible scene. I could not make her."
Suddenly she turns to me. "You foolish girl. You have wasted your father's day and risked your entire future. You are going to be a cripple for the rest of your life. Are you happy about that?" Sam is starting to cry. Miserably, I shake my head. Mother hands the squalling baby to Papa, who bounces him awkwardly in his arms. Crouching down in front of me, she shakes her finger. "You are your own worst enemy, young lady. And you are a coward. It is senseless to mistake fear for bravery." Her warm breath is yeasty on my face. "I feel sorry for you, but that's it. We are done trying to help you. It's your life, as your poor father said." After this, when I wake in the morning, I spread my fingers, working out the stiffness that creeps in overnight. I point my toes, feeling the crimp in my ankles, my calves, the dull sore ache behind my knees. The pain in my joints is like a needy pet that won't leave me alone. But I can't complain. I've forfeited that right.
My Letter to the World. 1940. It's not long before Andy is at the door again, awkwardly lugging a tripod, sketchbook under one arm, paintbrush like a bit between his teeth. "Would you mind if I set up my easel somewhere out of the way?" he asks, dumping his supplies in the doorway.
"You mean, in the house?"
He nods his chin toward the stairs.
"I was thinking upstairs, if you're okay with it."
I'm a little shocked at his nerve. Who shows up unannounced at a virtual stranger's house and practically asks to move in?
"Well, I promise to be quiet. You'll hardly know I'm here."
Nobody's been upstairs in years. There are a lot of empty bedrooms. And the truth is, I wouldn't mind the company. I nod.
"Well, good,"
he says with a grin. He gathers his supplies. "I'll try to stay out of the way of the witches." His footsteps are loud as he thumps up the stairs to the second floor. He sets up his easel in the southeast bedroom, the one that once was mine. From the window he can watch the steamers pull away from Port Clyde, heading to Monhegan and the open sea. Through the floorboards I hear him muttering, tapping his foot, humming. Hours later he comes downstairs with paint-stained fingers, the corner of his mouth purple from sticking a brush in it. "The witches and I are cohabitating just fine," he says. Betsy comes and goes. Like us, she knows better than to interrupt Andy while he's working. But unlike us, she has a hard time sitting still.
She gets a towel and a bucket of water and washes the dusty windows. She helps me feed the wet laundry through the wringer and hang it on the line. Donning one of my old aprons, she crouches in the dirt and plants a row of lettuce seeds in the vegetable garden. On warm evenings, when Andy has finished for the day, Betsy shows up with a basket, and we picnic down by the grove, where Papa built a fire pit long ago, and wedged boards between tree trunks for seats. Al and I watch Betsy and Andy collect driftwood and twigs to make a fire in the circle of rocks. From the campfire, the fields that separate us from the house in the distance look like sand. One rainy morning, Betsy shows up at the door, car keys in hand, and says,
"Now, madam, it's your day. Where to?"
I'm not sure I want a day, especially if it means I have to gussy myself up. Looking down at my old house dress, the socks bunched around my ankles, I say, "How about a cup of tea?"
"That would be lovely, when we get back. I want to take you on an adventure, Christina."
She strides over to the range and lifts the blue tea kettle, inspecting the bottom.
"Aha! I thought as much. This whole thing is on the verge of rusting through. Let's get you a new one."
"It doesn't even leak, Bets. It works just fine." She laughs.
"This whole house could fall down around your ears, and you'd still say it's just fine."
She points at my shoe.
"Just look at how worn that heel is. And have you seen the moth holes in Al's cap? Come on, my dear. I'm taking you to the department store in Rockland. Center Crane. They have everything. And don't worry, I'm buying."
I suppose, in some abstract way, I'd noticed the rust on the tea kettle. And the shaved heel of my old shoe. And the holes in Al's cap. These things don't bother me. They make me feel comfortable. Like a bird in a nest, feathered with scraps. But I know that Betsy means well. And truth be told, she seems to need a project. "All right," I relent. "I'll come." Betsy and Al help me into the station wagon in the drizzle and get me comfortably situated. And then we set off down the long drive to Rockland, half an hour away. At the first stop sign, she reaches over and pats my knee.
"See? Isn't this fun?"
"It makes you happy, doesn't it, Bets?"
"I like to be busy,"
she says.
"And useful. I think those are pretty basic human desires, don't you?"
I have to ponder this for a minute. Do I? Well, I used to think so. Now I'm not so sure.
"Idle hands," she says.
"The devil's playground. Is that what you think?" She laughs.
"My Puritan ancestors certainly did."
"Mine, too. But maybe they had it wrong." I gaze out the windshield at the fat raindrops that land on the glass only to be whisked away by the wipers. Betsy glances at me sideways and purses her lips, as if she wants to say something. But instead, with a slight tilt of her chin, she looks back at the road. Over lunch one day, split pea soup with ham, on a blanket in the grass, Betsy tells Al and me that Andy's father doesn't approve of her. He objected to their engagement, warning Andy that marriage would be a distraction, and babies even worse. But she doesn't care, she says. She finds N.C. arrogant, bullying, presumptuous. She thinks his colors are gaudy, and his characters cartoonish, calculated for the marketplace.
"Billboards for cream of wheat and Coca-Cola," she says disdainfully.
While she's talking, I watch Andy's face. He's gazing at her with a bemused expression. He doesn't nod, but he doesn't protest either. Betsy tells us that Andy needs to differentiate himself from his father. Take himself more seriously. Push himself harder. Take risks. She thinks he should limit his palette to starker colors. Simplify the composition of his images. Sharpen his tone.
"You're capable of it,"
she tells him, putting her hand on his shoulder.
"You don't even know your own power yet."
"Oh, please, Betsy, I'm just dabbling. I'm going to be a doctor," Andy says. She rolls her eyes at Al and me.
"He just had a one-man show in Boston and won a prize.
I don't know why he thinks he's going to be anything but a painter. I like the study of medicine. It's not your passion, Andy.
You're my passion. He wraps his arms around her waist, and she laughs, shrugging him off.
Go mix your tempera, she says.
Most mornings, Andy rows over by himself in a dory from Port Clyde, half a mile away. On the way to the house, swinging a tackle box full of paints and brushes, he ducks into the hen yard and emerges with half a dozen eggs, cradling them in one hand like juggling balls. He comes in the side door and chats with Al and me for a little while before heading upstairs. Andy's eye is drawn to every cracked or faded implement and receptacle and tool, objects that once were used daily and now exist, like relics, to mark a way of life that is past. Through his perspective, I see familiar things anew. The pale pink wallpaper with tiny flowers. The red geraniums blooming in the window in their blue pots. The mahogany banister. The ship captain's barometer in the foyer. An earthenware crock on a shelf in the pantry. The blue pantry door, scratched by a long-ago dog. Some days Andy takes his sketch pad and tackle box to the shed, the barn, the fields. I watch from the kitchen window as he roams the property, loping unevenly down the grass, to peer at the words on the headstones in the cemetery. Sit on the pebbled shore. Gaze at the sudsy waves. When he comes back to the house, I offer him sourdough bread from the oven, sliced ham, haddock chowder, apple skillet cake. He settles on the stoop in the open doorway, cradling a bowl in one hand. And I sit in my chair, and we talk about our lives. He's the youngest of five, he tells me, with three doting sisters. A twisted right leg and a faulty hip kept him from walking properly as a child, from taking part in sports. You've probably noticed my limp. He was plagued with chest infections. His father was his only teacher, kept him out of school, apprenticed in his studio. Taught him all about the history of art, how to mix paints and stretch canvases. I was never like the other kids. Didn't fit in. I was an oddball, a misfit. No wonder we get along, I think. Betsy's told me a lot about you and Al, Andy continues. How Al chops firewood for everybody on the road, and you make dresses for ladies in town and even quilts. He points to the tiny flowers on my sleeve. Did you embroider these?
Yes, forget-me-nots, I add, because it's a little hard to tell.
Interesting, isn't it? What the mind is capable of, he muses, stretching out his hand and flexing his fingers. How the body can adapt if your mind refuses to be bowed. Those intricate stitches on the pillowcases you gave us, and here on this blouse. It's hard to believe your fingers can do the work, but they can because you will them to.
He takes his empty bowl to the counter, swipes a slice of apple cake from the skillet.
You're like me. You get on with it. I admire that. In sketch after sketch, Andy focuses on the house, silhouetted against the sky, a blot of smoke rising from a chimney, viewed from a drainpipe, the cove, the eye of a seagull overhead. Alone on the hill or surrounded by trees, as large as a castle, as small as a child's playhouse. Outbuildings appear, disappear. But there are constants. Field, house, horizon, sky. Field, house, horizon, sky.
Why do you draw the house so much? I ask him one day when we're sitting in the kitchen.
Oh, I don't know, he says, shifting on the stoop. He stares into space for a moment, drumming his fingers on the floor. I'm trying to capture something. The feel of this place. Not the place itself, exactly. D.H. Lawrence, he was a writer, but also a painter, wrote this line. Close to the body of things, there can be heard a stir that makes us and destroys us. I want to do that.
get close to the body of things, as close as I can. That means going back to the same material again and again, digging deeper every time. He laughs, rubbing a hand through his hair. I sound like a crazy person, don't I?
I just think it would get boring.
I know, you'd think it would. He shakes his head. People say I'm a realist, but truthfully, my paintings are never quite real. I take away what I don't like and put myself in its place.
What do you mean yourself?
That's my little secret, Christina, he says. I am always painting myself. There's a single bed with a rusty, creaking frame, my old bed, in the room upstairs where Andy has set up his easel. When Al finishes his chores in the afternoon, he often goes up there and watches Andy paint for a while before drifting off for a nap. One day, offhandedly, chatting in the doorway with Al and me before heading upstairs, Andy mentions that he doesn't like being observed. He wants to work in private.
I'll stop coming up then, Al says.
Oh no, that's not what I'm talking about, Andy says. I like it when you're there.
But he's watching, I say. We're both watching.
Andy laughs, shaking his head. It's different with you two.
He's himself around you,
Betsy says when I relay this conversation to her. Because you and Al don't need anything from him. You let him do what he wants.
It's our entertainment, I tell her. Not much happens around here, you know.
And it's true. For so long, this house was filled to the dormers. I used to wake every morning to a cacophony of sounds coming through the walls and the floorboards. Papa's booming voice, the boys pounding up and down the stairs, Mamay scolding them to slow down, the barking dog and crowing rooster. Then it got so quiet. But now I wake in the morning and think, Andy is coming today. The day is transformed, and he hasn't even gotten here yet. 1900 to 1912. On winter afternoons, when the sun goes down by 3:30, and wind howls through the cracks, we huddle near the wood stove wrapped in blankets, drinking warm milk and tea in the dim light of a whale oil lamp. Papa shows Al and Sam and me how to make the knots he learned as a sailor. An overhand bow, a clove hitch, a sheet bend double, a lark's head, a lariat loop. He hands us wooden needles and tries to show us how to knit, though the boys scoff, refusing to learn. He teaches us to whittle whistles and small boats out of wood. We line them up on the mantelpiece, and when the weather warms, we take these boats down to the bay to see who sails best. I watch my tall, large-limbed father, his blonde, shaggy head bowed over his miniature boat, muttering to himself in Swedish, coaxing the vessel along in the choppy water. Mamay told me that several months before I was born, Papa's brother Bernd sailed over from Gothenburg to spend the winter here, and the two of them built a crib for me and painted it white. Bernd is the only Olausen who has ever visited us. On a low shelf in the shell room, behind a giant conch, I discover a wooden box filled with a motley collection of objects. A whalebone comb, a horsehair toothbrush, a painted tin soldier from a long-ago children's set, a few rocks and minerals.
Whose is this? I ask Mamay.
Your father's.
What are all these things?
You'll have to ask him.
So later that afternoon, when Papa comes in from milking, I bring him the box.
Mamay said this is yours.
Papa shrugs.
That's nothing. I don't know why I kept it. Just bits and pieces I brought with me from Sweden.
Weighing a black lump of coal in my hand, I ask, why did you save this? He reaches for it, rubs his fingers over its metallic ebony planes.
Anthracite, he says. It's almost pure carbon, made from decomposed plant and animal life from millions of years ago. I had a teacher once who taught me about rocks and minerals.
In your village in Sweden? He nods.
Jalinje.
Jalinje, I repeat. The word is strange. Jalinje. So you keep it to remind you of home? He blows out a noisy breath.
Perhaps.
Do you miss it?
Not really. I miss some things, I suppose.
Like?
Oh, I don't know. A bread called svartbrød, with salmon and sour cream. And a fried potato cake called ragamunk, my sister used to make. Maybe the lingonberries.
But what about your sister and your mother? And that's when he tells me about the squalid, low-ceilinged two-room hut in the village of Jalinje that his family of 10 shared with a cow, their surest hedge against starvation. His father, a drunkard with two moods, brooding and raging, who terrorized him and his 7 younger siblings, and worked occasionally at a peat farm as a day laborer when he was desperate enough. Papa's own constant stomach-churning hunger. More than once, he says, he avoided jail by eluding police on a long chase through cobbled streets after stealing a rasher of pork, a jug of maple syrup. From an early age, he knew there wasn't much of a future for him in Jalinje. No jobs. None he was qualified for, even in the big city of Gothenburg, 60 miles away. Though a quick study, he paid little attention in school. Knew how to read only the simplest stories. Never learned a trade. He taught himself to knit so he could help his ma, who earned a few coins making scarves and mittens and hats. But that was no job for a man, he says. So when he heard about a trading ship bound for New York, he rose in the dark to be the first at the dock at Gothenburg Harbor. The captain scoffed.
15 years old? Too young to leave your mama.
But Papa was determined.
She won't miss me, he told him. One less mouth to feed. A few more coins for the rest. 6 babies.
The youngest, his brother Sven, not even a year old, had starved to death a month before. And so he set sail with the captain and his small crew, across and back and around the world. As months turned into years, his past began to recede. He sent money to his mother, and talked, as all the sailors did, about going home. But the more time he spent away from Jalinje, the less he missed it. He didn't miss tripping over his brothers and sisters, not to mention the cow. He didn't miss that dingy hovel with its slop pail in the corner and the rank smell of unwashed bodies. The dank confines of a ship's belly might not have been much of an improvement, but at least you could rise from its depths onto a wide deck and gaze up at a vast sky sprinkled with stars and the yolk of a moon. It's surprising that Papa knows as much as he does about farming, given that he grew up in a hovel and spent his 20s at sea. Mother says he's just a quick study at whatever he puts his mind to. He restored the inn to a family home, raises cows and sheep and chickens for milk and meat and wool and eggs. He plants corn and peas and potatoes in the rocky soil, rotating them yearly, and he set up a farm store on the property to sell them. His customers come by boat from Port Clyde and St. George and Pleasant Point, loading their dories with produce and rowing back to where they're from. Having discovered that seaweed in the fields keeps the ground moist and the weeds down in the summer, Papa corrals Al and Sam and me to collect and distribute it. It takes 2 of us, our hands encased in thick cotton gloves, to steer a heavy wheelbarrow down to the water's edge at low tide. We rip the kelp from the rocks, pulling up barnacles and crabs and snails, and load the barrow with spongy green strands bubbled at the ends, and flat, wide strips fluted like pie crust. The gloves are stiff and unwieldy. It's easier to grab it without them, so we take them off, rinsing our hands in ocean water to wash off the slime.
Then we push the wheelbarrow up the hill to the newly furrowed field, where we grab big handfuls of cold kelp, squishing it between our fingers and scattering it down the rows.
"Push it back,"
Papa calls from where he's hoeing.
"Don't smother the plants."
Papa is always dreaming up projects to make money. His flock of sheep is growing. And though he sells wool to local people, one season he decides to box up the bulk of it and send it away to be carded and spun and dyed and sold out of state for a higher price. The following summer, he constructs a fishing weir with a neighbor in the cove between Bird Point and Hawthorne Point. Now that it's winter, he's decided that he will harvest freshwater ice, which can be loaded onto ships and transported easily and cheaply by steamer ship on the nearby sea lanes to Boston and beyond. He'll store it in an ice house Captain Sam built that has been standing empty for decades. Like any crop, ice is delicate and mercurial. Bright sun or a sudden storm can ruin it. There's no guarantee, until the ice is received in Boston, that Papa will get paid. He waits until February, when the ice on Vinyl's Pond is 14 to 16 inches thick, and offers money to other farmers to help him clear the snow with horses and plows. Up before dawn on frigid mornings, they use a workhorse to pull the clearing scraper, a series of boards attached together to create a flat bottom that angles back about 8 feet wide, and a 3-foot-wide snow scraper to remove heavier, wetter ice. Several men saw through the ice with hand saws fused to long iron T-bar handles, shedding coats and scarves and hats as they warm up. It is hard work, but these men and horses are accustomed to hard work. When a slab of ice is cut and floating, 12 inches above the syrupy water, the men hold float hooks, long poles with spiky ends, to keep the ice where they want it. After this comes the tedious work of cutting and loading these floats onto flatbed trailers behind horses that will transport them to the ice house behind the barn. There the blocks will be stacked and stored in sawdust, some set aside to sell to locals, and the rest to wait until a carrier bound for Massachusetts is ready in the cove. The morning of the harvest, after Papa has left the house, I dress in the dark, layering sweaters and trousers over my long underwear and pulling on 2 pairs of socks. I meet Al in the downstairs hall, and we head out into the mist, blowing our breath at each other, and make our way toward Vinyl's Pond to watch the horses harnessed to plows trek back and forth on the thick ice, deepening the grooves. Snow falls softly, like flour through a sifter, accumulating in drifts. We spot Papa in the distance, leading Blackie and the plow. He sees us, too.
"Stay off the ice!"
he shouts. When Al and I reach the edge, we stand silently, watching the men do their work. Blackie prances skittishly, tossing his head. He's a nervous horse. I've spent hours in the paddock devising routines to calm him. He's wearing the choke rope I fashioned around his neck several days ago to control him when he gets spooked. One of the men has broken his float hook in a block of ice, and everyone is distracted, offering suggestions, when I notice that Blackie is sliding in slow motion toward the lip of the ice. All at once there's a high-pitched whinny. His eyes roll in terror as he plunges into the breath-stopping cold, flailing and churning in the water. The plow teeters on the edge. Without thinking, I run toward Papa across the ice.
"Damn it, get back!"
Papa yells.
"Grab the choke rope!" I call, motioning to my own neck. "Cut off his breath!"
Papa gestures to some of the men, and they join arms, elbow to elbow, Papa in the middle and several holding his belt. He leans far out over the horse's head and grasps the rope, pulling it tight. After a moment, Blackie quiets. Papa manages to pull him up onto the slab by his harness, forelegs first, then belly, and finally his powerful thick haunches. For a moment the horse stands as if frozen. front and back legs apart like a statue. Then he dips his head and shakes his mane, spraying water. At the supper table that night, Papa tells Mame and Mother that I am the most ornery and stubborn child he has. And the only reason he didn't wring my neck for running onto the ice is that my quick thinking probably saved Blackie's life. A drowned horse, we all know, would have been a big loss. I wonder where she gets that from, Mother says. In the evenings, once or twice a month, local farmers come by the house to drink whiskey and play cards around the dining table. Papa is different from the others, with his quiet ways and his Swedish accent. But the fact that they're all farmers and fishermen is enough of a bond. After Mother and Mame have gone to bed, Al and I sit on the stairs, just out of sight, and listen to their stories. The more Richard Wooten drinks, the more he rambles.
There's treasure in that mystery tunnel, by God there is. One of these days, I swear I'll get my hands on it.
Al and I are fascinated by the legend of Mystery Tunnel. According to local legend, a 200-foot tunnel was carved out of rock near Bird Point by early settlers as a place to hide from passing pirates and Abenaki Indians.
I came this close. This close, Richard says.
His voice softens, and I have to lean close to the banister to hear.
Pitch black. Not a star in the sky. I sneak down there with a lantern. I'm digging for who knows how long. Hours it's gotta be. How many times have you told this story? 100?
Someone scoffs. Richard ignores him.
And then I see it. The glint of treasure.
You do not.
I do. With my own eyes. And then...
The men grumble and laugh.
Ah, come on. Now he's just making it up.
Spit it out, Richard, Papa says. It disappears. Like that.
I hear the snap of his fingers.
Just as I was reaching for it. It was there. And then it was gone.
Rough luck,
one of them shouts.
To treasure.
To treasure.
The next evening, Al and I slip out of the house with a candle nub and make our way down to Bird Point. The lip of the tunnel is dark and mysterious. Our flickering candle keeps sputtering out. It's eerily silent as we creep along. About 50 feet in, fallen rocks block the path. I feel a strange relief. We probably would have dared ourselves to continue. Would we have found the buried treasure? Or would we have disappeared in the depths of the tunnel, never to be found? Al and I take our adventures where we can find them. Several weeks later, he wakes me up in the middle of the night, a finger to his lips, and whispers,
"Follow me."
I pull on a house dress over my nightgown and my old leather shoes over my socks and leave the snug cocoon of my bed. As soon as we're outside, I see a glowing orange ball several hundred yards out in the harbor, its reflection splashed across the water. Then I realize what it is. A ship on fire.
Been burning for hours, Al says.
A lime coaster, headed to Thomaston, no doubt.
Should we wake Papa?
Nah.
Maybe he could help.
A dory came ashore with a group of men a while ago. Nothing anybody can do now.
For more than an hour, we sit in the grass. The freighter blazes in the dark, its destruction a thing of beauty. I gaze at Al, his face illuminated in the glow. I think about his favorite book, Treasure Island, about a boy who runs away to sea in search of buried treasure. Mrs. Crowley, seeing how often Al thumbed through the pages of the copy on her shelf, gave it to him when school let out for the summer. "For our seafaring Alvaro," she wrote on the inside cover in her neat handwriting. "May you embark on many adventures." Months later, the ribs of that lime coaster are visible when the tide is low. Papa and Al row out to the wreck and strip the hull of its oak planking, and after stacking and weighting them to make them straight, they use them to rebuild the ice house floor. Every weekday, Al and I walk together to the Wing School No. 4 in Cushing a mile and a half away. With my unsteady gait, it takes a long time to get there. I try to focus on my steps, but I tumble so often that my knees and elbows are constantly bruised and scraped, despite the cotton padding. The sides of my feet are tough and calloused. Al complains the whole way.
Geez, the cows are faster than you. I could have been there and back by now.
Go ahead then, I tell him, but he never does. It helps if I swing my body forward, using my arms for balance, though even that doesn't always work. When I fall, Al sighs and says,
Come on, now we're really going to be late.
But when he pulls me up, he puts all his weight into it. Sometimes we walk with two neighbor girls, Anne and Mary Connors, but only when their mother insists on it. They cluck their tongues and kick at sticks when I trip and fall behind.
Oh, Lord, again,
Mary mutters, and the two of them whisper together so Al and I can't hear. At school, I wait until the cloakroom is empty before taking off my knee pads and armbands and stashing them in my lunch pail. The other kids can be mean. Leslie Brown trips me as I walk up the aisle to get a book, and I crash into Gertrude Gibbons' desk.
Watch it, clumsy,
Gertrude says under her breath. There are things I could say. Few of us at the Wing School No. 4 have picture-perfect lives. Gertrude Gibbons's mother ran off to Portland with a man who worked at the paper mill in Augusta and never looked back. Leslie's stepfather beats him with a belt. The Connors girls have no father. He didn't go away. He was never here. It's a small town, and we know more about one another than any of us might wish. One afternoon, Al and I are sitting outdoors with our lunch pails under the shade of an elm in the schoolyard, when Leslie and another boy begin to circle and taunt.
What's wrong with you? You're not normal, you know that.
The tips of Al's ears redden, but he stays quiet. He's small and slight, no match for these rough boys with chaw in their cheeks. I don't want him to defend me anyway. I'm more than a year older than he is. A girl in my grade, Sadie Ham, strolls over. She's a thin, tough girl, as solid as a sunflower stalk, brown-eyed, round-faced, with a nimbus of curly sunflower petal hair. Putting her hands on her hips, she juts her chin out at the boys.
That's enough. Sadie Bacon, Leslie says with a sneer. That's your name, right?
I don't think you want to play the name game with me, Leslie Brown. Turning to Al and me, Sadie says,
Okay if I join you?
Al doesn't look too happy about it, but I pat the grass. Sadie shares her sandwich with me, meatloaf sliced thin on bread with butter. She tells us she lives with her two older sisters in an apartment above the drugstore, where one sister works behind the counter. She doesn't mention her parents, and I don't ask. Mind if I sit with you tomorrow? She asks. Al cuts his eyes at me. I ignore him.
Sure you can, I say.
For so long, Al has been my only companion. He is as familiar to me as the walls of the kitchen or the path to the barn. It would be nice, I think, to have a friend. On land, Al is shy and awkward. He doesn't talk much. In a crowd of people, he acts like he wants to be somewhere, anywhere else. He doesn't know what to do with his hands, which hang like oversized gloves from his wrists. But out on the ocean, when we pull up to one of Papa's blue and white buoys bobbing in the water, he is purposeful and self-assured. With a quick yank on the rope, he can tell how many lobsters are in the trap far below. Al has always wanted to be a lobsterman. The summer he turns 8, Papa decides he's old enough to learn. He takes Al out in an old skiff a few afternoons a week, and sometimes I go along for the ride. We row out so far that our white house looks like a speck on the hill. It makes me nervous to be on the open ocean in the small boat. My balance is precarious enough on land. The water is deep and dark around us. The planks are rough, and salt water pools between the ribs of the boat, pickling my bare feet and dampening the hem of my dress. I fidget and sigh, impatient to get back. But Al is in his element. Papa hands each of us a hand line. It's a simple rig. Cotton line coated with linseed oil and wrapped around a piece of wood he whittled on each end to better hold the line. There's a big hook at the end and a lead weight to make it sink. He teaches us to bait the hook with chum he keeps in an old bucket covered by a board. We let our lines down slowly, and then we wait. I don't catch anything, but Al's line is magic. Is it the way he fastens his bait? The way he jigs his line, making the fish believe it's alive? Or is it something else? A serene confidence that fish will come? Half a dozen times, there's an almost imperceptible tug on the line between Al's forefinger and thumb. And he, in response, pulls hard on the line to set his hook, and then, hand over hand, hauls in a flapping haddock or cod from the depths of the sea, over the gunwales into our boat. With the skill of a surgeon, he removes the hook from the fish and detangles the line. He insists on rowing all the way back by himself. When we land at the dock, he holds up his palms, red and raw, and grins. He's proud of his blisters. Within a few years, Al has restored Papa's old skiff and learned how to build and rig his own traps, fashioning the bows and sills from scraps of lumber, knitting twine for the heads, and using rocks as weights to sink them. The traps he builds are better than Papa's, he boasts, and he's right. They brim with lobster. He constructs a fish house behind the barn to store the lobster traps and bait barrels, boat caulking and buoys, fishing nets and nails. Before long, he has taken over the blue and white buoys, and is selling lobster to customers in Cushing and as far away as Port Clyde. Al can't wait to be done with book learning. He's just biding his time, he says, counting the days until he can spend every waking moment in his precious boat. Mrs. Crowley told me once, the nicest thing anybody has ever said to me, that I'm one of the brightest students she's ever taught. Long before the others, I have finished my reading and arithmetic. She's always giving me extra work to do and books to read. I appreciate the compliment. But maybe if I could run and play like the other kids, I would be as impatient and distracted as they are. The truth is, when I'm immersed in a book, I'm less aware of the pain in my unpredictable arms and legs. At school, we're learning about the Salem witch trials. Between 1692 and 1693, Mrs. Crowley tells us, 250 women were accused of witchcraft, 150 imprisoned, and 19 hanged. They could be convicted by spectral evidence, an accuser's assertion that they appeared in ghostly form, and witches' marks, moles or warts. Gossip, hearsay, and rumors were admitted as evidence. The chief magistrate, John Hawthorne, was notoriously ruthless. He acted more like a prosecutor than an impartial judge.
"He's related to us, you know,"
Mame tells me when I relay this lesson after school. The two of us are sitting by the Glenwood Range in the kitchen, darning socks.
"Remember those three Hawthorne men who left Salem in the middle of winter? It was 50 years after the trials. They were running from the shame,"
pulling another sock out of the pile. Mame tells me about Bridget Bishop, an innkeeper accused of stealing eggs and transforming herself into a cat. Bridget was an eccentric whose colorful clothing, a red bodice covered with lacework in particular, was believed to be a sign of the devil. After two confessed witches testified that she was part of their coven, she was arrested, thrown into a dank cell, and fed rotten tubers and broth. It took only a few days in those conditions, Mame says, for a respectable woman to resemble a trapped and desperate animal. In the courtroom, in front of a jeering crowd, John Hawthorne asked her,
"How do you know that you are not a witch?"
She answered, "I know nothing of it." Justice Hawthorne narrowed his eyes, lifted his index finger. When he jabbed it at her, she stepped back as if struck.
"Why, look you," he said.
You are taken now in a flat lie.
He slammed the flat of his hand on the table in front of him. Mamay slams her hand down, demonstrating, and the accusers and spectators erupted in a frenzy.
Bridget Bishop knew it was over, Mamay says. She'd be condemned to death like the others, left to swing on Gallows Hill until someone took pity and cut down her corpse, probably in the middle of the night. Like many of the condemned, she was a middle-aged loner, with a house and property that had already been confiscated. Who was there to show support for her? Who would speak to her character? No one. Eventually, the governor of Massachusetts put a stop to the proceedings. One by one, the magistrates of the Superior Court recanted, expressing remorse and sorrow about their rush to judgment. John Hawthorne alone was silent. He never expressed the slightest regret. Even after his death 25 years later, peacefully, in prosperous comfort, his reputation for cold-blooded cruelty lingered. Mamay tells me about the curse that Bridget Bishop placed on Hawthorne's descendants. Well, not a curse exactly, but a warning, a reckoning.
You have to admire that woman, she says, using the only power she possessed to instill the fear of God into him. Or the fear of something. But I believe it. I think your ancestors brought the witches with them from Salem. Their spirits haunt this place.
For goodness sake. My mother sighs loudly in the next room. She thinks her mother fills my head with outlandish ideas. She thinks I should pay less attention to Mamay's stories and more attention to my stitches. When I ask Papa about the curse, he says he doesn't know about that. But he does know the Hawthorns were a notoriously unruly bunch. A fierce, rugged Scots-Irish clan who emigrated to New England from Northern Ireland in the 1600s, they quickly developed a reputation for sadism against their perceived enemies.
Beating Quakers, double-crossing Indians, and selling them into slavery, things like that, he says.
How do you know all this? I ask.
I drank some whiskey with your grandfather once, a long time ago, he says.
The spring of my 10th year, Mother is heavy with child. Mamay and I are doing most of the cooking, which at the tail end of a long winter consists mostly of old root vegetables from the cellar, dried fish and meat from the smoker, stews and chowders. It's so cold and choppy on the water that Papa and Al can't go out in the dory. Sam has a hacking cough and a runny nose. The earth is soggy. If I fall on my way to school, I end up mud-soiled and damp-skirted all day. None of us have much to be cheerful about. On the way home from school one wet afternoon, I see Papa's buggy on the road ahead of me, a familiar badger shape with a blue bonnet on the seat beside him, and I know Miss Freely is coming to deliver Mother's baby. When I get home, my brothers and I sit in the kitchen with Papa. Rain pummels the roof and the windows, heavy, slurry, and we can all feel the dampness in our bones. I peel off my socks and drape them over the range. Even the wood smoke from the Glenwood is damp. The birth is uneventful. Mother is used to this by now. But after Fred is born, she is different, slow to rise when he needs her. She hands him to Mamay and goes back to bed in the middle of the day. When Fred cries for her milk, Mother turns the other way, and Mamay has to stir together cow's milk and water with a sprinkle of sugar. She puts a soapstone in the oven and wraps it in a cloth to put in his crib when he goes down for a nap. But it's no substitute for his mama, she says. Al and I hurry home from school to take Fred from his crib and rock him in the chair, give him baths in the tin tub. Before we bathe him, he smells sour and damp, like he's been pulled out of a hole in the field. Afterward, he smells like a puppy. We all try to think of ways to cheer Mother up. Mamay makes pound cake with lemon peel, her favorite kind. Papa builds a 4-drawer dresser for her linens. Blue is Mother's favorite color,
So I decide I'll surprise her by painting some objects around the house a cheerful blue. Al shakes his head when I tell him my plan. Painting a chair is not going to help.
I know, I say.
But I hope maybe it will. I ask Mamay's permission.